Okay, hello everybody. Thanks for the invitation to be here. It's been a great pleasure to be here, especially with the nice sunshine compared to the snowstorm in New York that I just escaped. So today I'll tell you about stripped envelope supernovae. And the main thrust of my talk will be is that statistical studies, thorough statistical studies of these objects, will give us a new method to answer old questions about their progenitors and their explosion mechanism. The group I've had the pleasure to work with at NYU consists of Federica Bianco, who is the co-chair of the LSST Transient Survey, Shan Huang, who's a postdoc, Og Rao, who was a postdoc and is now an SF fellow at Harvard, Kieran Finn, who's a graduate student, and Yu-Tian Liu, who's finishing up this year as a graduate student with me. So just to remind us again of the supernova zoo, we've had, of course, discussions about stripped envelope supernovae. Type 2s show strong hydrogen. Type 1Bs don't show hydrogen, but strong helium lines, so don't show strong hydrogen, but strong helium lines. The 1Cs don't show hydrogen nor helium, so they're a bit the rejects of the classification scheme, and that's going to be important when we discuss rates. But they can show some silicon line, or weak silicon line, that can be sometimes be confused with type 1As, which are of course important for cosmology. So that's something that our cosmology colleagues also care about, the non-1As. And then recently, and we haven't discussed those in detail so far, the last 20 years, a subtype of 1Cs have piqued a lot of interest. These are called broadline type 1Cs. I know it's a mouthful. If you know, talk about it often enough, it comes very easily off your tongue. So these are broadline type 1Cs and the only type of supernova connected with long-duration gamma ray bursts. And we've had now a large sample of around 15 supernova GRBs, where every time the GRB was close enough to get a spectrum, we saw the fingerprint of a broadline type 1C. So these broad lines indicate large expansion velocities up to 20,000 kilometers a second, so you know, almost a tenth of the speed of light, where not a lot of ejecta is moving at these high speeds. And when people use, such as you know, Paolo Mazzali, who will talk tomorrow, when they use light curves and spectra and their spectral synthesis codes, they get large kinetic energies. These are the numbers that I won't fill in. He will talk about them in detail tomorrow. But they can reach up to the 10 to 52 ergs. Though, of course, these are model-dependent values, whether you use 1D or 2D models. So keep that in mind. Now, they have, of course, transition objects. We've heard about those, these type 2Bs. They show strong hydrogen lines at the beginning when you take spectra. But over time, those hydrogen lines disappear and the helium lines become important. So the time-dependent aspect of classification is important, and I'll discuss that too today. And of course, in the recent 10 years, where we have lots of great surveys, as well as, you know, pay attention to weird objects, not just type 1As, we found many other exotic transients, including the superluminous supernova that I'll discuss today and also will be discussed tomorrow. Now, what are the stars that we think give rise to them? Of course, that's one of the main themes of this conference. So as Stephen, of course, nicely summarized, we know that most type 2s come from red supergiants. We've seen them in pre-explosion HST images. We think the ones without hydrogen come from stripped stars that have been removed off the outermost layer of hydrogen, and the next inner one is visible, which is that's why we see the helium lines. And then the 1Cs might be due to the most stripped stars, so both hydrogen and helium may have been removed. And in terms of this population, we find that only a small fraction of these most stripped stars, only perhaps 1%, can give rise to a GRB that has jets that are coming out of the star successfully. Of course, the big question we have in the field is which kinds of massive stripped stars are able to give rise to successful jets? And that's a big outstanding question in the field. You just don't need a massive star and a stripped star, but also those that are able to produce these jets, because there are lots of broadline type 1Cs without GRBs that we have observed. The other question, of course, we have is, could you have hidden helium? In all the various models, it's really hard to remove all of the helium. So a perennial question we've had in the last 20 years in the field is, could you have hidden helium? Could you hide helium in broadline type 1Cs because of the high velocities involved? And could you hide helium in the normal 1Cs because of non-thermal excitation? So I will discuss those questions. Now, just quickly remind us, why is it important to address what are the progenitors of supernova and gamma bursts? Of course, answering that question impacts many fields of astrophysics. We've heard a lot about stellar and high-energy astrophysics, from gravitational waves, chemical enrichment history of the universe. And something that hasn't been mentioned is that GRBs are powerful beacons that are observed over huge cosmological distances, up to redshifts of 8 and 10, so when the universe was only 530 million years old. So these are powerful tools. You know, NASA has a whole satellite dedicated to finding them, you know, SWIFT, that's been going on strong since 2004. And so they're very powerful tools to indicate the star formation history of the universe. However, of course, before we can use them as tools, we first have to understand from which progenitors they come and what kind of stars they trace before we can use them as star formation indicators. Now, what are the ways to strip the massive star? We've discussed this before, just as an overview. Very quickly, you could have single massive stars, Wolf-Rayet stars, we talked about those, that have the metallicity-dependent winds. Of course, the exact dependence on metallicity is somewhat debated. The mass loss rates themselves are debated. Of course, when you go to massive star conferences, that's, you know, one big discussion point. Binaries, we've heard a lot about those. They're important because you can make stripped stars from low-mass stars, you know, going down to 8 solar masses, and they can remove hydrogen and helium even at low metallicity. And then thirdly, of course, we've heard about these chemical homogeneous models would happen in highly rotating stars that have been suggested as progenitors for GRBs, with a high rotation rate of the core is required for all the various GRB models, and they could actually not strip the outer hydrogen envelope, but actually burn it, you know, through convection, meridional flows, move it into the core and burn it and get rid of that way. Of course, fourth, there's a fourth channel that we've heard about, which are eruptions. Though given kind of Raffaella Margudi's recent work, she finds that only 10% of stripped envelope supernovas seem to have these kinds of eruptions within 500 days before they explode. And I'm looking forward to more statistical studies to answer that question too. Now, as Stephen told you, the direct study to get pre-explosion images to nail down these models has not been working successfully. And even the one case of the 1B that he discussed, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, what model, whether it's a binary or single star, would be applicable. So there's a strong need for more indirect but statistically powerful studies to do stellar forensics, to figure out which stars give rise to these explosions. There are basically two ways, supernova and GRB explosion properties, and using supernova rates in host galaxy environments. And my group has worked on this field. Of course, many other groups have also worked, but given the short amount of time we have today, I will discuss mostly my group's work. Now, we are starting the era of big data. So large statistical studies based on large data sets that our group and others have published. So in this field, we have had in the recent years lots of great data sets, and actually some will be still outstanding. Analysis too, so in the last couple of years, we had, you know, the approach of strong systematic studies and statistical studies. Of course, in the field of type 2s too, and I won't have time to go into that, but it's a really exciting time to, you know, in general field to do this using data that has been freely available after publication, which is not a given. So there are various archives. I'd like to give a shout out to WISE-REP, Weizmann Institute, and also the recent Opal Supernova Catalog that's been really great, and I've shown here, to access the data in a, you know, friendly, user-friendly way. So before we can do statistics, we need data. And such a data set was released by us in 2014 based on both photometry, including the infrared, as well as spectroscopy. And the main point here is that we have lots of data as a function of time for the same object to see if there are any ones that transition between one type and the other to get robust supernova classification. So with this data set that I've shown here, we doubled the world supply of well-observed events. And we also make all our data public, not just our data consisting of spectra and light curves, but actually also our code. So usually between data and results, there's code. Of course, that's in the spirit of many people here, you know, Mesa and others. But your code is also very important, and very few groups have been publishing their code. And so we've been doing that using GitHub. So it was some amount of work involved to make it streamlined, and I invite you all to go and check it out and give us feedback about what we could improve. We also released publicly our templates for what's called the Supernova ID library. So SNID is one of the main classification tools that people are using that depends on a spectral library sample, and we've augmented that by a factor of 2 and also improved the identifications of those in the library. Turns out some of them had incorrect IDs. So it has been a big impact. Of course, you know, having a correct library is important for correctly fingerprinting any new objects you're finding. GRB supernova, also type 1A for cosmology. And we've also been developing new tools that I will discuss today and a very solid statistical framework. I mean, so far we've had a great time and, you know, chasing weird objects. And it's a very discovery-driven field that we're in for stripped envelope supernova. But now, having big data sets, we also need the solid statistical framework. So, of course, that's in line with NSF's mission for sustainable cyber infrastructure and transparency. Okay, so what are the implications for fingerprinting? It might sound boring and technical, but it's really important. So what we found was that actually lots of 1Cs are really 1Bs. They were misclassified for various reasons I can discuss later. And so the question we had was, well, now that we have the recent result in 2014, could it be that the rate that had been established by Loss in 2011, namely that the 1Cs seem to be much more common than 1Bs, which was a huge surprise, could that be incorrect? So what we did was we analyzed the Loss sample. There have been 3 papers out based on that. One of them is led by Isaac Shivers, who's a graduate student at Berkeley, and he did a Herculean effort of re-IDing all lost supernova using our augmented supernova library. And what we found is that actually 1Bs are more common than 1Cs. And that's very reasonable that the most stripped stars should be less common, because it's really hard to get rid of the helium. So that's a paper that has been accepted in PSP. It's on AstroPH, but PSP has been a hard time getting it actually fully published, so this should be out soon in its published form. Now, what about the fraction of all stripped envelope supernova? Has that changed? No. The answer is no. Stripped envelope supernova is still 30% of all core collapse supernova, as shown here with these air bars, which is, you know, uncannily consistent with work that Husana and Salma did in 2012, showing that based on binary interactions, you would get a stripped envelope rate of around 33%. So that's still consistent. So I think the picture is emerging that also Stephen discussed earlier, that binaries are common, perhaps not the only channel, but more likely the most common channel for producing stripped envelope supernovae. So we had a recent paper that underlined that result, where Orr Grauer used the IDs that Isaac Shivers had given us, the correct IDs, and analyzed supernova rates as a function of galaxy property, here shown in terms of their metallicities. And again, the finding is consistent with earlier work, namely that the rate is so high. The rate of stripped envelope supernova is so high, especially going up, you know, as shown here, that they're inconsistent with just single stars. But they are more consistent with binaries, where you just go down the IMF, down to 8 solar masses, to produce such a high rate. Now, of course, we've not been the only group working on this. There's been lots of other work that has been going on earlier. But they've mostly been number ratios. But we actually have absolute rates, which is a huge difference. It's really crucial. And we have also the lowest air bar, the smallest air bars of all the groups. But we're all consistent, namely that the rates seem to be too high to be just be explained by single stars. Of course, there are lots of caveats. One main one that I actually also raised myself in 2008 already is that LOSS is a galaxy-targeted survey. So we might be missing lots of interesting objects at low metallicities, lower luminosities, that were not targeted as part of LOSS. And of course, that's why in the future, when IPTF or ZTF or any of the other great untargeted surveys have rates, will be really interesting to see what is happening at the low metallicities. Of course, there are model uncertainties in the BPAS models that we used by J.J. Eldridge, you know, what are the mass loss rates, and so forth. So that's, of course, all, you know, given the caveats, and I'm happy to discuss those during question and answer. What about broadline tablets use and the connection with GRBs? There again is an emerging picture that binaries are common. So one question I mentioned earlier has been the helium problem. So could it be that the helium is there but just not observed because of the high velocities involved? So what we did to answer this question was, well, we used the forward modeling approach. So what we did was we first made an average broadline type 1c spectrum because we want to probe the whole population, not just some simple object or one specific object that happens to be nearby and well studied. So we used the whole population, we produced average broadline type 1c with the standard deviation kind of snake around it to quantify the diversity of broadline type 1c spectra. We did it at different phases. And so this is shown in black, and yellow is the standard deviation spectrum. Now then we saw, well, can you reproduce a broadline 1c by broadening a 1c? I know it's, again, lots of words. So what we did was we did reproduce a broadline type 1c by just using an average 1c spectrum that we also produced, convolved it with a Gaussian, to simulate the smearing that's happening due to the high velocities involved in these explosions. And voila, what we find is that in here in blue, this convolved average 1c spectrum can reproduce well, except at the lower wavelengths where you have a lot of ion opacity, so our kind of simple approach didn't work out. But at longer wavelengths, we produced a broadline type 1c. Now, what about 1bs? Could it be that there's helium, like in a 1b, but it's just been broadened out and we don't see it any longer? So we did the same thing for where we produced and synthesized a broadened 1b. And what we found was that if you had a broadened 1b, we would have seen it. The helium line should still have been visible, but we don't see it. So what we then concluded was that, you know, broadline type 1c spectrum most likely have no smeared out helium layer. And I'm given kind of caveats about non-thermal excitation, that binaries or perhaps eruptions might be responsible for removing all of the helium. So of course, I'm happy to discuss the caveats later. We looked also at velocities, because velocities are important for indicating the dynamics of the explosion. And so what we did was we had the largest data sets using both our own data set as well as published data that we analyzed in our framework. We developed a novel method to measure velocities in these blended spectra using Markov chain Monte Carlo. And what we found was that using, you know, lots of data, that broadline type 1c's with GRBs have systematically higher velocities than broadline type 1c's without GRBs by around 6,000 kilometers a second at maximum. So what we then concluded was that these broadline type 1c's might have had a jet inside them, but it was choked, it was stifled. Because again, that's something that should happen in nature too. Not all of the jets are able to get out and produce gamma ray bursts, but some of them would have been produced but just didn't make it out. And so those are the ones we think giving rise to broadline type 1c's that had jets that accelerated the ejecta to velocities that are higher than those for 1c's, but not as high as broadline type 1c's with successful, powerful jets. Now, you might wonder about viewing angle effects. Could it be that these are all off-axis GRBs? But we don't think so, because the environments of supernova GRBs are different than broadline type 1c's without GRBs. If it were viewing angle effects, they should be the same. Okay, I'll skip this in the concern of time. So the last thing I would like to mention is this exciting field that has started in the last 10 years, which is the field of superluminous supernovae that are defined to be more luminous than around minus 21 magnitudes, meaning they're more luminous by a factor of 100 at least than normal core collapse supernovae. Of course, the big questions we have is, what powers their brilliance? And we hear much more about it tomorrow. And what are their progenitors? And of course, this is a very active field. We had a great conference in September, in July, and then of course coming up soon, we'll have more of those discussions. And these are shown here. These are the most recent members of the 1c family. They don't show hydrogen helium. There's one object or two that might show, and we can discuss those. But most of them don't show hydrogen helium. So in this recent paper that has been submitted and almost accepted, and it's on AstroPH, we did a first systematic investigation of the spectral properties of the whole 1C family. We concentrated on velocities because these indicate the dynamics of the explosion, and we used the largest spectroscopic data sets as shown here. And of course, as you can see here, there's a publication bias. Superluminous supernovae have been known only for the last 10 years. They have high redshifts, they're harder to observe, but everybody and their grandma, basically, are observing them and publishing them. So what we found, which is really important and really exciting and new, is that superluminous supernovae, as shown here, have high velocities, much higher than those of normal 1Cs, and similar to broadline type 1Cs, some of which are connected with GRBs. So this connection between superluminous supernova gamma burst is definitely established also through this method, the other pieces of evidence, and not just gamma ray burst, but broadline type 1Cs in general. So what does this mean in terms of the implications for progenitors and explosion mechanisms? Well, the various mechanisms that have been suggested, again, we'll hear more about them tomorrow, have some tension with these high velocities. In general, even for the normal broadline type 1Cs, it's really hard to produce these broad lines and high velocities. So for the interaction model, as suggested here, it's really hard to produce these high velocities, but to look at this in detail, we need more hydro models. For the 1D magneton model that has been suggested by people here, of course, they predict a velocity plateau that we do not see in most of our objects. They also predict narrow lines, which we also don't see. So this is not observed for the specific line that we're using, the iron 2 line. So there's a strong need for 2D models, and that has been done already recently, and those don't show the velocity plateau. So again, nature tells us we need multi-D spectra and multi-D models. Okay, so these are my conclusions. We have started the era of statistical analysis of both normal and exotic supernova. It's really a great treasure trove of insights that have been a new aspect and a new addition to our prior work based on work of lots of people, including people here in the audience. We should get our IDs right. We should get our fingerprinting right. So there are no excuses now any longer. We have all the SNIT templates out there. So all your surveys, please use them. And others, such as Superfit and Gelato, should also include them because the data are all out there and they're really important. And in terms of the statistical analysis, we think that there's no hidden helium layer in broadline type 1Cs, and that's really hard to produce in terms of progenitors. It seems like broadline type 1Cs know about the GRB, basically, but they don't care about the GRB strengths. That was the part I had to skip. And last but not least, as a population at least, there seems to be strong connection between superluminous supernova and GRBs, or broadline type 1Cs in general, given the high velocities that superluminous 1Cs seem to show as a population. So that will be a strong constraint, again, as a population for the various models that we'll be discussing tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Okay, I guess Elliot has the first question.
Just to clarify the connection between broadline 1Cs and GRBs. So if our basic model of GRBs is right, there have to be a large number of broadline 1Cs where the GRB is not beamed towards us.
Yes.
So those must exist, but yes. Your statement is those don't dominate the broadline 1C population?
Yeah, so I have a backup slide because that's a very common question. So where are the off-axis GRBs? They have to be out there, especially if the jets are highly beamed, 10 degrees or so, as some people suggest. Now, I think there are two parts to the answer. One is they do exist, but we haven't observed them yet. So these would have very fast rising and declining optical afterglows. People have tried to look for them. Pan-STARRS try to, but it's really hard to just see a flash and nothing else. There have been suggestions. Then in terms of candidates, I think the broadline type 1Cs at low metallicity and high velocity are really good candidates. And actually, I don't know if I can discuss this, but there's been a suggestion by the PTF team, IPTF team, that they might have found such an object, and that's being written up. So new radio service will help to find off-axis GRBs, because again, they should have a signature, or they do not exist. Again, this picture that we have of GRBs is actually only the case for cosmological GRBs. For the nearby ones, when people look at the opening angle, these are actually much more spherical. So you wouldn't miss them as much.
I agree with all of this, but this wasn't exactly what I was getting at. I thought you were making a statement about the environments of broadline 1Cs and GRBs being different. But there has to be, if our JET model is right, there have to be a lot of broadline 1Cs that should have the same environment.
They may not dominate the population. So the next step will be looking at untargeted surveys, because there are they do have these galaxies that are low metallicity and low luminosity, as we see in GRBs. They have them in their targets, and you know, in this untargeted way. So now I didn't have time to discuss it, but we have a PTF project where we're looking at the host galaxies of broadline type 1Cs without GRBs from this untargeted survey. And what we're finding is still, even then, they're different. So they should be out there. They should be out there, and we should be finding them. But again, I don't think we're missing too many. I think at the end of the day, most of the nearby ones, we're finding them, because they're not highly collimated. They're actually almost spherical.
So the high velocity feature in the superluminous one is very exciting. But the circumstellar material also may not be spherical. So it's the more like a disk-like and shape. So we might see just central engine effects even with circumstellar interaction. So we need a circumstellar interaction for the very luminosity, but maybe velocity is a bit different.
Yeah, so I think you're referring to some of the superluminous 1Cs that have these bumpy light curves with lots of peaks that cannot be explained by one model.
That's a point.
So that's right. So I looked into whether those have lower velocities, because there's in our sample too. And even those, including 12 dm, has high velocity. So if there's an interaction model, perhaps there's another component, but whatever it is, it would have to produce the high velocities.
So I wrote a review of superluminous supernovae that's in this Springer handbook of supernovae or whatever. But in it, just quoting Matt Nichols' research, actually, he found that the velocity dispersion for superluminous supernovae was, well, the velocity was 10,500 on average for superluminous supernovae, plus or minus like 3,000, and it was like 9,800 for normal 1Bs and Cs, plus or minus like 2,500 or something like that.
So which line did he use?
What's that?
We can talk about which line did he use, because that becomes important in how you actually measure lines.
Yeah, well, there then was a difference over time when, because the superluminous ones decayed slower than the other ones. But also there's a difference in ejecta mass, so that superluminous supernovae have like twice as much ejecta as a broadline 1C. At late times they sort of look the same from a nebular perspective, but and then they have a very different light curve evolution as well. I mean, just in terms of like it's much longer for superluminous supernovae. So I'm not so sure about this connection between the two.
I wanted to be very clear. The connection I see is only in the high velocities of broad lines. And again, we can talk about what he used and which line he used if he gets lower values than we do. But I think if you look at our paper that's out, you will see, and again, we make public all our data, you will see that these are higher velocities, very robustly, and they're broader lines. We have mean spectra too that compare them. So I'd be interested to see this kind of work that you mentioned in terms of work by Matt Nichols. We've discussed that with him in terms of comparing our velocity measurements for the same objects. And he himself, he had a very simple kind of Gaussian fitting to iron, and he actually himself mentioned that, our values might be more robust. And in general, also for that velocity plateaus he saw, he actually didn't include some of the late spectra that we do for the same objects where we see that it's going down. But I'm happy to discuss kind of more of these differences offline. Yeah, so the ejecta mass, that's very interesting. Though the thing about ejecta mass is that it relies on many things, which is, how you measure the light curve shape, how you measure the velocity, our NETS assumptions, that assume spherical symmetry. So, we have this kind of discussions also for normal 1Bs, 1Cs. So I think there might be differences in ejecta masses. Ideally, we should just compare the observables, not, some model-dependent value at the end. But the connection I see is only in the broad lines. There might be other differences in higher ejecta masses if they come from higher mass stars. That makes sense. But the connection here was specifically for the broad lines and the high velocities, which we're confident about.
I wanted to make a comment to Elliot's question. the velocities. There are many 1C supernovae with velocities comparably high as 1Cs in GRB supernovae. The kinetic, the masses are higher, so that the kinetic and the final kinetic energy is computed with radiation transport models end up to be quite high. And significantly higher than you derive for 1C, for broadline 1Cs. There is an element of asymmetry to take into account. These kinetic energies you compute for GRB supernovae are influenced, are seen edge on. You see them down at a very small viewing angle with respect to the asymmetry axis of the supernova that can easily cause a factor of 2 or 3. It's not as asymmetric as a gamma ray burst, which is extremely beamed, but these GRB supernovae are enhanced. All their quantities are easily enhanced, increased by an effect of viewing angle by a factor of 2 or 3, at least.
And in terms of the velocities, again, we can talk about this offline against the supernova people, but again, we have to be very careful which line we use, which method we use when we measure velocities, because again, that's really dependent on the method you use, and we have a plot for that. For 94i, the silicon line gives you a different velocity versus the iron line. The SINEL models give you a different velocity than, you know, Paolo's model. So we just have to be consistent in using the same method for these comparisons. Yeah.
Okay, we should probably move on. Let's thank Mariam again. Okay.